Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LeDuc, the producer of The Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, WAMC's president, CEO, and political observer Alan Chartok and Roundtable host Joe Donahue are joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing the most important issues of the week. On Monday, July 26, Joe and Alan spent the last portion of the program speaking with Dr. James Fagan, an immunology and allergy specialist in New Hyde Park, New York.
When it comes to the Delta variant and vaccine refusal, I mean, where are we right now? Because it seems very unsettling.
Yeah, it certainly is unsettling. In fact, it's unbelievable that at this stage of the game that we still have such vaccination hesitancy. It is inexplicable. For the life of me, I can't explain it. I don't understand it. We know that, 49% of the total U.S. population has been fully vaccinated. Well, that's great, except there's another 51% who have not. And, this is making life extremely difficult for all of us. You know, just when we thought we were rounding the curve and looking at the end of the tunnel, we seem to be going backward. And it's predictable, which makes it even more frustrating. It's predictable because the more people who are not vaccinated, the greater the pool of those individuals who are susceptible to contracting SARS-CoV-2 and developing COVID-19. And the more people who get this infection, the more likely there will be other variants, mutations, and other variants that develop, some of which may be completely resistant to the vaccines that we have. The good news is that the Delta variant, which is the predominant variant in the United States right now, is sensitive to the current vaccines. There are some issues with J&J, which we can talk about, but the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines are very effective against moderate to severe illness, hospitalization, and death. It's almost 100% against hospitalization and death. And again, I'm talking about the Delta variant. So, Joe, I don't know how we could possibly be in this situation at this point in time.
I did want to go to a particular place here, Jim, and that is the kids. In the beginning, it was almost as if the kids didn't exist when we started talking about the disease and where it was going. Now, all of a sudden, we're paying a lot of attention to it. Why is that?
Well, when this started, I think it was less than 2% of new infections involved kids. We know that in general, children, certainly kids under 10 years of age, tend to be more resistant to SARS-CoV-2. Why is that? Well, we don't really understand. I think that some of it could be the fact that, they are frequently, young kids are frequently exposed to other types of coronaviruses. Remember, coronavirus, I'm not talking about SARS-CoV-2 now, but other coronaviruses are very common causes of the common cold. And, young kids can get 6 to 12 viral upper respiratory infections each year. Some of that is caused by coronavirus. Now, so young kids may have developed some immune responses to coronavirus that older people don't have. And that's one possible explanation. What's going on now we're seeing, I think it's 24% of all cases involve kids now. And kids, are getting sicker. And this may have to do with the Delta variant. And the problem with the Delta variant is that it is very, very contagious, and it is very, very transmissible. So infectivity and transmissibility are logarithmically increased with the Delta variant. And that's really important because it all sort of boils down to what we call the viral load, which means how much virus you actually have in your nose and your nasopharynx, because that's really going to be the key for determining transmissibility. And because the Delta variant is so contagious, it tends to have an enormous viral load. It makes it much more infective and much more contagious. And that may be one of the reasons why, kids are getting this as well.
Okay, so a lot of follow-up questions, but number one, come the next 2 or 3 weeks, should kids, all kids, be wearing masks when they go to school?
Yeah. So the American Academy of Pediatrics put out a statement, and in their statement they said that all kids 2 years of age and older should be wearing masks.
So first graders and 12th graders.
First graders and 12th graders.
Even if they've been vaccinated.
Even if they have been vaccinated. You know, and I think that the purpose of wearing masks is not to eliminate, you know, infection. It's to mitigate infection. The what happens in the schools is really a reflection of what's happening in the community. So if there is a large population of unvaccinated people in the community, then the incidence of infection in the schools is going to increase. You know, the problem with saying to kids who are vaccinated, well, you don't have to wear a mask in school, but the kids who are unvaccinated have to wear, you know, there's going to be a problem in terms of acceptance of that. I think overall, as much as I would love to say to the kids, go to school, be normal, forget about your masks, you know, learn, have fun, we're not there yet. And we're, you know, again, without, you know, well, I could point a finger. We're there because of the unvaccinated population. So I do agree with the AAP in terms of right now, where we're at right now in terms of the case rates, which are going up, not down all of a sudden. I think it would make sense for the kids to wear a mask. It's a mitigating factor. And the last thing that the kids want, that their families want, that the communities want, is for us to have to close the school and go back to remote learning.
Sure.
So that's the American Academy of Pediatrics. But meanwhile, at the CDC, they are saying that it should be for the unvaccinated. They are not going as far as all kids in school. And then say, while preferable to wear masks, it's up to the individual school district. Is that strong enough wording? And it does seem to be passing the buck to the school districts who have to fight this fight in their communities.
Yeah. In my opinion, no. I think the CDC is making a mistake in doing this. And I would not at all be surprised if they changed their tune with this. I think that, you know, there are issues with the CDC. First of all, do they have the authority to mandate mask wearing in schools? Probably not. It probably is up to the local school districts. But the issue, and I understand where the CDC is coming from, they want everyone to get vaccinated. And, the talk that's circulating is, well, if I get vaccinated and they're telling me that, you know, that will protect me, why are they telling me I have to wear a mask then? And so I think that people who are somewhat hesitant about being vaccinated grab on to stuff like that. So the CDC is in sort of a difficult position right now. In my opinion, I think they're going to change their tune. For me, as a pediatrician, I absolutely want to see kids go back to school. There is, you know, there's no question that these kids should be in school learning, having all of the wonderful opportunities that all kids have in school in terms of socialization and all of the other activities that they're involved with. They got to get back to a normal life. And if wearing a mask, you know, for the next, you know, few months, whenever it, however long it is, it's going to help us get there, then it's worth it.
What about vaccinations, in terms of booster shots?
Yeah, that's a good one. So right now, there is no scientific evidence that would say that we need a booster shot if you've had any of the three vaccines. There is a problem, as everyone knows, with the, you know, in terms of the immune response to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. The response to Moderna and Pfizer are excellent. There are some, and it gets a little bit confusing, because there's some clinical data which have recently been reported that suggest that the neutralizing antibodies, even after the Pfizer and Moderna, tend to wane after 6 months or so after you've been fully vaccinated. Now, I take issue with that. And the reason I take issue with that is that you can't just, and you cannot just measure neutralizing antibodies and use that as a total sum of immune responsiveness. Because the, and you've heard me say this on the show many times, the antibodies are the tip of the iceberg. What creates the antibodies is the cell-mediated immune responses that are going on that are the domain of the, you know, lymphocytes, the B cells and the T cells. So when you are fully vaccinated, or if you have been infected with COVID-19 and you are immunized to this infection, if you confront the SARS-CoV-2 again, your immune response is going to be almost immediately activated, and you will see within a short period of time a significant increase in the amount of neutralizing antibodies. So I'm not convinced as an immunologist that you really need to have a booster at this point in time. If we see that clinically, we see that patients who have been fully vaccinated after 6 months, 9 months, after a year, are now getting infected, and they're having symptoms, not asymptomatic, but they're having symptoms, and they're moderate to severe illness, then I might change my tune.
All right. So a couple of follow-up questions. Number one, when it comes, we have a letter from James who asked about the J&J vaccine, because many people are saying, and many people are doing this, and he's interested in your input, of if you have received the J&J vaccine, should you also now go and get Moderna or Pfizer as a booster or as a backup to sufficiently boost the efficacy of J&J?
My response, Joe, is yes.
Okay.
Now, let me surprise some people, because it is not approved. You know, a booster vaccine is not approved, which means that if you go in and say, well, I've been vaccinated with Moderna or Pfizer, but I'm nervous, if I've been vaccinated with Johnson & Johnson, but I'm nervous about that and I'd like to get another vaccine with Moderna and Pfizer, it may not be so easy to do that. Remember, all the vaccines are free, but there may be some issues, and the vaccination sites may be very unwilling to do that. Why? Because it is not approved. I would not be at all surprised if, hopefully, shortly down the road, that will change. I think, in my opinion, I think it makes sense to do that.
Here's a question about infrastructure, and I find this fascinating. We are seeing a number of breakthrough cases of people who receive Pfizer and Moderna who are getting sick and they're getting symptoms. And people are asking this question, I think it's a really good one, which is, okay, so my friend has been vaccinated, we hang out over the weekend, everything's fine, and then they get sick. And under the old rules, you know, the ones from a couple months ago, we were supposed to, then you would be asked to go into quarantine and so forth. But according to what the CDC says now, that if your friend comes down with COVID, your vaccinated friend comes down with COVID, that you, if you are vaccinated, would not have to worry, that you should just go about your regular day unless you present symptoms. I understand why that scientifically makes sense, but I also find it concerning.
Okay, so here's what I would respond to that. Everyone's immune response is different, and it's probably governed by a lot of factors, including some genetic factors, some of which we know about, some of which we may not know about. I mean, the question is, why do some people who are vaccinated, if they are exposed to COVID-19, how come they get sick? How come they get sick? And other people who are vaccinated with against COVID-19 have no problems at all. Remember, the vaccines were designed not to prevent not to prevent infection completely, but to prevent moderate to severe infection, hospitalization, and death. And they're pretty effective in doing that. But there are, you know, we all have, different responses in terms of our immune system. There's also another component of the immune system called the innate immune system, which is a part of the mucous membrane in the respiratory tract. And all of this may be very, very important in distinguishing who is going to get actual infection and who won't will be completely asymptomatic. And so because we also know that the majority of people who are vaccinated will not, you know, have an illness when they are exposed to COVID-19. So I think that the CDC recommendations, I still think that they are correct at this point. And what they're recommending is, just as you said, if you are fully vaccinated and are exposed to someone who, and if that, even if that someone is vaccinated and gets sick and you're exposed to that person, you do not need to quarantine and you don't even need to get tested unless you start developing any COVID-19-like symptoms. And I agree with that right now. I mean, I may change my mind as time goes on, but I agree with that right now. And I think, again, the best way to explain this is everyone is different, and everyone's response, you know, to this infection may be a little different. It may take someone's immune, adaptive immune system a little bit longer to kick in, and so they may develop, they may develop symptoms. But again, the important thing, the important message to everybody is, if you're fully vaccinated, you will be protected against severe disease, hospitalization, and death. And okay, that's really, really important. You know, you may not be protected against some symptomatic COVID, but you're not going to be in the hospital, you're not going to die. And here's the most important thing. The vaccinated people, we know for a fact that they do not transmit the infection to the extent that unvaccinated people do. And again, that has to do with what I said before about the viral load. If you're the ability to transmit COVID-19 to someone else is dependent on the viral load. How much virus are you harboring in your nose and in your nasopharynx? So when you cough and you sneeze, how many viral particles are coming out? Because there's a threshold for that. If it's just a few, it may be enough to have, by the way, if you have a little bit in there, you may have a positive COVID-19 test. But if you're asymptomatic, and you've been vaccinated, it's very unlikely that you're going to be able to transmit the infection. And, you know, if you can't transmit the infection and you don't get terribly sick from the infection, boy, that's wonderful, isn't it?
Dr. Jim Fagan on the Roundtable panel on Monday, July 26th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Wednesday, July 28th, Joe Donahue and Alan Chartok welcomed you, Albany adjunct professor and investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo, Edward Hamilton, distinguished professor of computer science at RPI and faculty associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, Fran Berman, and actor, educator, and co-founder and artistic director of Wham Theater, Kristen Van Genhoven.
I'm still coming off of that, watching the hearings yesterday. I have to say, I have never in my life, and I've watched a lot of television, a lot of hearings, I've never been felt anything was as compelling as those four guys talking about what had happened to them and laying it all out, and the N-word being thrown around by these mobsters. And, you know, I think the American people have a much better idea of what this was all about now than they did before.
Okay, so let's begin. We'll talk about what happened yesterday. Of course, we had an abbreviated show because of the hearings that Alan just referenced, and they were very compelling. They were very vivid and disturbing on all fronts. I think that it certainly was a a reminder, if less anyone had forgotten, of just how horrible things were on that day, but to hear the officers who were there and their personal experiences was quite riveting. Four police officers told a House committee investigating the Capitol attack that they had been beaten, crushed, and tasered. All of them were telling us that Trump sent us, one officer said. Another described a crowd calling him by a racist slur. Representative Liz Cheney, one of the two Republican members, said the committee should investigate Donald Trump's role. The Justice Department declined to defend a congressional ally of Trump in a lawsuit over the riot. So those are just some of the headlines coming out of the investigation that began yesterday. More hearings expected, I believe, but yesterday was day one. Alan, you said your piece, but anything you'd like to add to it?
Yeah, not much, but I do think that the American people, many of whom, you know, think they know a lot, don't listen all the time. They don't pay attention. And this was just one more reinforcement for the American people about what, how contentious it was and what had happened.
All right. You were the Rosemary, what do you think?
Well, I remain, as you know, really skeptical about this whole process, which I think is misplaced. It should be in the criminal justice system, not in Congress. It was extremely compelling. I'm glad they got a chance to tell their story, but the people who needed to hear it were not listening. McCarthy said he had committee meetings. Jim Jordan said he was busy with lots of congressional work. Elise Stefanik was, I don't know.
Well, she didn't even say.
Obstetrician's appointment, who knows.
She wouldn't respond
to it. So my main takeaway was yay to Nancy Pelosi, who said no to Jim Jordan, because that would have been a completely different proceeding had he been there. It would have been interrupted, that compelling, very moving testimony about putting your life on the line to save the Capitol would have been interrupted with baloney about Black Lives Matter and protests in Portland, and that did not happen because she stood up to McCarthy's bluff. So good for her. If you have to do it, that's the way to do it. But I still feel like it's not the right forum.
But if people are listening and watching,
are they?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I think I mean this sounds flip, but I mean it. You know, I think more people were interested in Simone Biles yesterday than they were in the committee hearings.
I agree.
But I think anyone who did have contact with that yesterday was immediately, it was just hard to not, especially with the video and the testimony and the people who were actually there, it's hard not to be changed in some way by it. Fran?
I was just wondering if anybody had watched, because it was all over the news that I was watching, and, you know, you pretty much directly saw the testimony, and, you know, from everything I've read, I mean, this is just appalling. You know, I cannot figure out for the life of me how, you know, any of these reactions to this are in the public interest. But I also was
not
reading.
What do you mean, any of the reactions?
Any of the reactions from the Republican side, you know, like I was too busy. I was getting my nails done. You know what? Okay, I made that one up. But, you know, but that's essentially what
they said. I don't know. Maybe check. That may not be the case. They may have actually said that.
Well, we don't know what the numbers are.
It's just appalling to me that you wouldn't listen to something that is trying to get at the heart of something incredibly tragic that happened. And it's in the public interest to understand. However, my question to you and maybe to our listeners is, you know, I was not reading Breitbart News. You know, I was not listening to conservative media. I'm really curious as to what was said about the proceedings from that point of view.
Well, I think the Republicans are in a bad spot here, and they know it. You know, they made up a series of lies, an attempt to obfuscate what's going on in these hearings. And they didn't want the hearings. They'll do anything not to have them. But the American people, and not every American, but an awful lot of Americans, were looking at that and seeing these guys and hearing the terrible things that happened to them. They thought they were going to die.
Yeah.
And
some of their fellow officer did die.
And the black policeman who said that they kept yelling the N-word at him. You know, this is something the American people need to know about.
Kristen.
Yeah, it's interesting that you talked about how more people were probably watching the information about Simone Biles, because I think there is strangely a connection, because while I agree with Fran that it's in the wrong venue and it should be in the criminal justice system.
You mean
that's
Rosemary.
Rosemary. That's okay.
I'm sorry.
We all
I'm
sound
sorry,
alike.
Rosemary.
You're fine.
We're both short.
I'm calling in. You guys all have the pleasure of being in the same room, but I'm grateful that I could call in today, so thank you for that. But I wanted to share that I think it was really, it is really important that there's a venue for all of the officers who are experiencing so much trauma to share their stories. So while the people who are watching it are probably all of us who already think that this is, you know, as been said, is a sham, and that this is the worst attack on democracy, you know, that we all, those of us who are watching, believe that, there is huge value in those folks who were part of it having the forum to share their story. It's such a big part of the healing that they have to do. And I think the same is true for Simone Biles. So there is strangely a connection between the two and the opportunity to share their vulnerability as part of the healing.
Can I add one thing to that? Because I had a similar feeling that when those guys were talking, all four of the officers were amazingly anti-Trump. They said strongly anti-Trump things. He did it. It's his fault, which is not the usual point of view that you hear from men in uniform.
Yeah.
They might have been people who voted for Trump in an earlier time. And in a way, I thought that would play to Republicans who are saying it's just a, you know, it's just a witch hunt, it's just a bipartisan attack on him. They sort of played into that, I thought.
Well, I sure disagree with that, of course, and you know that, Rosemary. I think that they were incredibly disarming. I thought that the Republicans would say what you just said, of course. But, you know, this was a moment when they were talking about the fear of losing their lives, and they all went out of their way to say that it wasn't political. And by the way, I just want to respond to you and to Fran on one level. Yes. The Justice Department should investigate this, but and will be, but it's not either or. These are people, and I've interviewed many of these congressional people who said they thought they were going to die too, that people were guarding the doors, and I thought that was, you know,
well,
isn't
that what makes the hypocrisy of all this? I mean, Kevin McCarthy was one of them too, but he's
and he called the White House. And
yeah,
called the White House and he begged Trump to intervene. So
I like the lawsuit that Eric Smallwell has brought in that the Justice Department advanced today against Mo Brooks from Alabama, who he absolutely accused him of inciting a riot. And it's going to proceed to next level in court. So good. That's the way to handle it.
That's one way to handle it.
If this congressional hearing could prove that there were members of Congress who helped promote it, opened doors for it, did anything at all to assist that, that would be worth it. But
well, we don't know. Those hearings will go on, right?
We'll see.
It also feels really important to have it in the history books, you know, in the future, that this was just like how important it was for January 6th to happen and all these other parts of it. You know, it's so important that this happens just for the structure of government and for reading in the future that this did get spoken about, you know, and it was one of the top items on Fox News, you know, very similar article to the ones that we were reading on the New York Times, the Washington Post. So it is making its way, even if, you know, there's probably millions of people who aren't paying any attention.
Material. Kristen, what was the spin on Fox News? This is Fran.
Interestingly, it was almost exactly the same article as what was in the Washington Post.
Wow.
You know, the headline, the subheading, of course, was against Nancy Pelosi. But when you actually clicked on the article, it was really sharing. It was not holding back from what I could take from it. Because I was curious, like was mentioned, you know, how is the conservative news covering this. So I went to Fox News, and I was, dare I say, impressed. I mean, I rolled my eyes at the subheading, but then when I actually clicked on the article, I thought, oh, they're not, they are showing empathy for the stories that were shared, and they are sharing what was said.
Fox News has never been the problem. It's Fox commentary, and that continues to be just repulsive.
Yeah. Hannity's main thing yesterday was the commission's only goal is to smear Donald Trump.
Exactly. Which, as I say, even the police officers.
Well, it needs to be said that without Rupert Murdoch, Hannity wouldn't have that platform, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In other words, right. Fox News allows that to happen.
Well, he's more than Fox News. He's the Fox network. And so overall, Fox is the problem. But it's not the news that it has individual articles that are fair and balanced is not surprising.
But it also took them about 2 seconds to take it off the front page to put in about the mask mandates.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was the real issue for them. You know, I'm also curious as to what, when you think about where we are, As this investigation goes forward and more information is brought, I mean, I will say I thought that the presentation was remarkable yesterday. I thought they just did an amazing job. There were some, and I don't have the statistic, I don't even have it close, but like 45,000 hours of tape that they have on this.
Is that right?
Of film. They said it on NPR yesterday, from all the different sources, from people's personal cameras to the surveillance, to what was taken by the networks and everybody else, which is why different things keep emerging and coming out.
Think about all the lies that have been told about this. The Republicans have said this was the Antifa people, or this was Black Lives Matter people, or this was, you know, and that was all put to rest. That's why I thought that it was a remarkable hearing yesterday.
So, by the way, I mean, like an interesting spin for me is I think we all have strong and perhaps mixed feelings about living in a surveillance state. And this is a positive. Many negatives, but this is a positive because when you have something like this, or when you have something like the Boston Marathon or something like that, and you're really able to garner all of this information, sometimes it's helpful. A lot of times it's really intrusive, but sometimes it's helpful.
The hearing was informative, but there has been no visible investigation of the financing of those tens of thousands of people who assaulted our Constitution on January 6th. If they don't follow the money, we'll never pin down how it was organized or what was really going on. Haven't we learned anything since Watergate? They need to follow the money. Even during the second impeachment trial, there was nothing about who paid for the buses, the hotels, and everything else.
Now, they say they're going to follow the money. In the interviews that they've had with
Benny
Thompson, is that
Benny Thompson? Yeah. Yes,
they say they're going to follow the money, and we can only hope that they do.
Joe says, if we haven't already, we should posit that Trump had 4 years or more to gather damaging dirt on all the Republicans. It may be they are acting like ostriches with their heads in the ground because he can destroy them.
Well, I think the last part is certainly right. They're doing it because he can destroy them. And he's proven that. Although yesterday we had an interesting election in Texas, in which the Trump-endorsed candidate lost, and that offers me, at least, who's always looking for encouragement, some encouragement.
Well, I thought that was funny because he was texting all or whatever he does now. I get the emails, his statements, and he was making statements all day about the election in Texas and how it was going to prove. And then once the results came out, it's sort of been radio silence.
So. And let's remember, a lot of Democrats voted in that election because the Democrat had been eliminated. So now it was two Republicans, and Democrats certainly weren't going to vote for the Trump-endorsed candidate.
Let's see. Rudy says, I'm asking the question, not knowing the answer, although I have my opinions. Where have the police unions been in backing their brothers in these hearings? Any statements by the police unions or national police organizations? It seems we are in middle of crickets in the field. Mm. Anyone know an answer to that?
No, there has been nothing.
It's a really interesting question, though.
That was my point initially, that these are men who normally would have been in the Trump camp or conventional thinking would put them in the Trump camp, but now they were so virulently anti-Trump in the hearings yesterday. It was quite a change.
Well, I mean...
And reason, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's somebody...
there's motivation for
that,
yeah. If
you're being killed, you know, okay.
I love the one comment that one of them said, that I said to them as they were trying to get me, I have children.
Yeah.
Well, and I was really struck by the comment of, like, they were seeing lots of folks who had the flags with the blue lines, which shows support for the police, and yet they were showing no respect for the police.
The police, right. You know, the officer saying of what that even as all this was going on, that they were making a mental note that, oh my God, there's a Confederate flag going through the Capitol
right.
at this moment.
Right.
Although, Alan, if you follow your comment, and that struck me too, but it's sort of like, it's like okay to kill people without children, but it's not okay to kill people without children.
Yeah, you're right.
It's like, really?
You're right, of course. You're right, of course, but I thought it was very poignant.
That's standard fare in negotiating with the bad guys, that you try to humanize yourself. You have kids, you know.
A spouse, I love animals. Children, right. Yeah, I have a cat. His name is
I'm going to Disney next week. Let me go.
I couldn't possibly do all these horrible things.
You know,
just
I think
it's kind of not okay to kill people, period. Yeah.
You know, it's very tough to trivialize what was going on there yesterday. I think... you know, these people were all seen as American heroes by, you know, in Kinzinger and others and Liz Cheney, who said it was horrible. I really couldn't take my eyes off that television.
Mary says they should subpoena all those Republicans who were hiding under tables and now say it was just tourists at the Capitol. Linda says, I was listening to the proceedings on WAMC on and off all day yesterday. During the testimony of one of the officers, he mentioned that there were 9,000 people storming the Capitol on January 6th. Yeah. I'm wondering if anyone else heard that and if it's true. I've not read anything about the actual number of insurrectionists that were at the Capitol on that day, and I'm not... been able to verify that number.
I did hear that and wondered the same thing.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was his impression or he had some number.
I think there were thousands.
Yeah.
This is an estimate on the part of law enforcement, by the way, who was there. So I do think that there were a lot of people. And I do know this, that what struck me was the estimation that it was only 150 law enforcement people guarding the Capitol, including a lot of people who just showed up because they knew it was the right thing to do, even though they didn't have to come.
My understanding on the numbers, too, is there's a differentiation between the people who, quote, stormed the Capitol, who actually breached the Capitol, and the people who were on the lawn, who
right.
went to the stairs and were scaling the building and that kind of thing.
You just want to make sure that the people who are estimating it are not the people who estimated the number of people at the inauguration.
That's right. That's right.
Good
point. All right. So thank you for that, Linda. We go to Adam, listening to the officers and feeling sympathetic for them. I cannot help feeling concerned for their stories. We're simultaneously exciting those sympathetic to the terrorists. I could see folks at home saying things like, yeah, let's do it again.
I have my Kafka T-shirt on today.
Yes, I see your Kafka T-shirt.
That tells it all.
Yeah. But again, you can't keep that, like, that can't be a reason for you not to do it.
No.
To have them
certainly
to give their
No, and
their
to Liz
stories.
Cheney's point, you know, if they don't do it, then that also does open the door for this to happen every January 6th, every 4 years.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Daisy says, I found the testimony riveting yesterday. I somewhat agree with Rosemary in that it will not make this will not make any difference to people in their Trump silos, but it might make a difference to that narrow segment of voters who determine our presidential elections.
And as I've said so many times, 5%, if you win by 5% in a presidential election, you can all look this up, that's regarded as a blowout. So, in other words, that 5% becomes very important.
Mary says, yesterday your representative blamed Nancy Pelosi for the January 6th riot. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. I have to put this in context.
Sure.
Mary says, hey, 21st District, New York voters. That was the key line. So this is, too, about Elise Stefanik, not about us. Yesterday, your representative blamed Nancy Pelosi for the January 6th riot. Do you agree or don't you care? And are you still planning to vote for her next year? Good question. We go to Carl. I trust that Ms. Armeo, after she listened and or watched the testimony of four law enforcement officers appropriately chastened, and their cynical view of the process as mere political theater. It may have been theater to Jim Jordan and Steve Scalise and Kevin McCarthy, but not to me and no doubt millions of others who found the searing testimony both moving and terrifying. We go to Annabelle. Who shows up at a rally with bear gas? Who shows up at a rally with Kevlar vests, combat helmets, and gas masks? Premeditated is written all over this wall.
You bet.
Well, and that continues to be such a big question, right? So many people knew that this was a possibility, and yet they were not prepared. That's always been like, what? How is that possible?
Mm-hmm. Where do you think we go from here, Alan?
Well, I think it's terribly important that the American people know exactly what's up. After all, Trump is a lying liar. And the big lie is here. He stood up there and he said, get down to the Capitol and I'm going with you. Just another lie. In the end, he is responsible for it. Now, my hope is that the investigations, as Rosemary hopes it happens, in the Justice Department, and as we heard yesterday by the Congress, who were most threatened. This was an attack on democracy. I sure hope something comes of it.
Alan Chartok on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, July 28th. Please note as you listen, any given topics, details, and facts may have changed and evolved since the panels took place live earlier in the week. We'll be back with more Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this short break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday's show, Alan Chartok and Joe Donahue welcomed publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman Ira Fussfeld and lecturer and adjunct professor in communications for SUNY New Paltz and RPI, Terry Gibson.
The big story, of course, is infrastructure. A bipartisan infrastructure pact clears a key Senate vote after a breakthrough in the talks. We've been talking a lot about this over the last couple of weeks, about the stops and starts on this legislation. What's going to work? What's not going to work? Is it going to go through? We have this agreement. The agreement has faltered. The Republicans are upset, blah, blah, blah. So now we have a measure that has White House support. Portman, Sinema say all significant disagreements have been resolved around roughly a $1 trillion package. They banded together on Wednesday to advance this proposal to improve the country's aging infrastructure, overcoming months of political deadlock on one of President Biden's signature economic policy priorities. The day of breakthrough began with news of a deal as a bipartisan bloc of 10 negotiators coalesced around a package to upgrade the nation's roads, bridges, pipes, ports, and internet connections. The announcement from some of the group leaders, including Senators Rob Portman, Republican of Ohio, and Kristen Sinema, Democrat of Arizona, capped off a series of frenetic talks that nearly collapsed amid behind-the-scenes battles about the new spending and, yes, how to pay for it. With that once-elusive agreement finally in hand, the Senate hours later then took its first formal legislative step. Lawmakers voted 67-32 to put themselves on track to begin debating infrastructure reform this week, clearing the first of many hurdles toward adopting a proposal that the White House has described as historic.
Alan Chartok.
Joe, did you ever read all of the Oz books? Not the original, but all, there were one after another.
Oh, yeah. The L. Frank Baum books?
Yeah. And remember, there were in each of those books an adventure to one of the lands of Oz.
Yes.
And one of them, of course, was the land of No. And many of the Republicans have lived in the land of No. So now, on this bill, they have a tough one. They have to either satisfy their mayors, their citizens, their governors, and fix the roads, the bridges. I always refer to the down bridges in Great Barrington, which is not all the selectmen's fault. But you know, they have to satisfy those people, or they have to satisfy the guy who is actually the emperor of the land of No. And that's Donald Trump, of course, because he doesn't want to see one thing happen on Biden's watch which will reflect well on the president. So here, these senators are between a rock and a hard place. On one hand, they have their mayors and their governors, and on the other hand, they have, the Prince of Darkness there. So what do they do? What do they do? Well, it's clear that in this case, the land of No is in a bad spot because they're going, apparently, and anything can change, believe me, they can, they're apparently going with common sense and what this country really needs.
I realize this is just a vote to start the debate, but 67-32, do you make anything out of that, Terry?
Well, I think it's good news versus the alternative, but I think we have to be very cautious about how we interpret this. I do think that when this is all said and done, there will finally be something that resembles this particular bill that will help out our infrastructure. But my concern is that this is taking way too long. And I do think that the Republicans continue to have a strategy of delay, drag this out as long as they can. While we spend all this time working to get this bipartisan infrastructure bill passed, we're not making progress on things like voting rights, things like gun regulations. Lots of other things are just not getting done, even spoken about, because this is just taking all the oxygen out. And I do think that's the strategy for the Republicans. I also feel like, well, let me think. You know, I have these two cats at home, and they have these little mice that they play with. And the way they play with those mice...
Is there toy mice?
It's two mice and two cats.
Two toy mice or real mice?
They're toy mice.
Okay. All right.
But I do feel like the way that the Republicans... way the Republicans are playing with the Democrats, I feel like is very much the way that my cat plays with these mice.
I see.
They're just kind of batting it around, playing around with it. We're going to give you a little, then we're going to take a little. And I just feel like it's this cat and mouse game that the Republicans continue to really control the speed and the destiny of where we're headed right now.
I have to say, though, that normally when I was a kid growing up and we had cats before I married a woman who was allergic to them, that the mouse usually ended up in a bloody heap on the floor.
Yeah, well, I am in this, you know, comparison, I am saying that the Republicans are the cat and the Democrats are the mouse. So I am concerned, very concerned. That
there will be the bloody heap on the floor.
Yes, exactly.
You know, let me take, before we go to Ira, let me just take a very quick disagreement with you. I think, Terry, this is really a major plus for Biden. Because, you know, you can say, yeah, well, what about all these other things? But it is a major achievement, and it is being scored that way so far. And I wouldn't be one bit surprised if you got one ex-president sitting there furious and trying to put a stop to this right now.
Well, I can't disagree with that. It's just that I think that the real sign of a real achievement will be when they actually get a bill passed and what that looks like. But
absolutely.
Yeah, no doubt,
you're
so
right.
Far, this is a positive for Biden if it follows through.
Well, I'm afraid it bothers me terribly to have to agree thoroughly with Alan on this.
Listen, you'll get over it.
Listen, this bill is wildly popular. The people in this country, regardless of their political stripe, want to see their bridges fixed. They want better broadband, all of the rest. I think that Schumer has got a chance here to maneuver this thing in such a way, and he pledges he will, that it's going to be done quickly, to Terry's point. And hopefully for Schumer, that will help build up his bona fides, because as I've
his
said
reputation.
On this, yeah, I don't believe he's been sterling as the majority leader. But the Republicans are going to be very pleased that they will put up a perfunctory challenge in certain corners, and then when the bill is passed, they'll all go home and tout the legislation that they helped bring in, and that's why you see all these road crews being hired, etc. So, and yes, it's going to help Biden, and it ought to, because it's been a priority of his. And I think the Republicans are in a corner, and to the, was it the Wizard of Oz? Is that the analogy?
Yeah.
We have already heard from him. He's already telling Republicans that this is a bad deal, and if the Republicans vote for the implication is if the Republicans vote for this, they're going to get primaried, and then we'll have to see that may be a very telling point in the future of this country. Because we've already seen Trump lose a primary that he supported the candidate in Texas, and the Texas candidate did not win. He might be terribly surprised to find out that that threat doesn't work, particularly when those Republicans that he's warning against have just passed a piece of very popular legislation.
I think it's important to remember, Ira, that Democrats voted in that election.
Yes, that's true. But
so they didn't vote for the Trump candidate, that's for sure. Important, you know.
Well, then the question is Trump as smart as he thinks he is? Because why did he go out on a limb knowing did he not know the political landscape?
You
there
may be
well
right.
Enough?
Maybe he didn't know. Yeah. And maybe he didn't know what a primary was in Texas.
if I'm remembering these.
I'm going to go with that.
He phoned Jonathan Swan, the terrific reporter for Axios, to vent and start blaming others for this loss. So he's trying to – it's like I picture a turtle in a toilet bowl trying to figure their way out. And he's paddling very
cat,
hard.
Cat, mice,
yeah,
fish,
we get a,
turtles, bowls.
Peter will
I
be
like
here
it,
in 10
Ira.
Minutes.
I really like that turtle in the toilet bowl.
But you know – what was I
don't
just going to
– flush.
There is another piece of this that we have to keep in mind, and that's that Nancy Pelosi is continuing to say that while she's watching what the Senate is doing, she's more focused on making sure that they do commit to doing this reconciliation process, which involves a much bigger, a $3+ trillion package, a much bigger package. And that's what she is really wanting to make sure that they do. And that commitment.
Try to make sure they do.
Yeah, well, what's that?
Try to make sure that they
do. But that commitment to getting the Senate Democrats to commit to doing that and getting it done, I think is going to continue to hover over how the Republicans deal with this. And
Biden calls up Nancy Pelosi on the phone and says, hey, this is going to be the signature achievement of my time so far, cut it out and wait until it passes, I have a feeling that's going to carry the day.
I don't know. I don't think it's too late, because he's already said he's committed to it as well.
Oh, yeah, he has. This was his bill. He wants it done. She's going to put it on the floor. And by the way, they'll have the votes because it has financial implications to pass it.
These are historic pieces of legislation.
Wait 10 seconds. Go
ahead. And they need to be passed, and the Democrats are going to recognize how important this is for history.
Let's go to the letters, and we talk to Russ, who says, the interesting thing about the Republican infrastructure bill are the pay-fors, mostly taken from unspent pandemic recovery funds. The overriding Republican objective is to force additional deficit spending to set up 2022 campaign promises of smaller government to rescue the economy from inflation.
That's a really good point and a good letter. And one of the things that I found disturbing about this new agreement is that the Republicans insisted that this not be funded by asking the IRS to go after people that don't pay their taxes, which was the Democrats' original idea for funding this.
A little guilty, are they?
I find that to be just incredible that they're not willing to do that. I think that's a great letter. It's a good point.
All right. Let's go to Eric by calling Republican leader McCarthy a moron. Nancy Pelosi has rekindled a controversy from the Trump administration. While his Secretary of State reportedly referred to our former president as a moron, his Secretary of Defense was said to have judged him to be an imbecile. This is an important distinction, as a difference of 20 IQ points in a national leader can have profound implications for our country. As with Trump, this controversy should be resolved for McCarthy as soon as possible. That from Eric. We thank Eric for that.
You know, I hate this name calling. It's childish and it's unbecoming of our politicians, particularly the senior politicians. And my question is, should she be above that? And I would argue, yes, she should be above that, but I don't blame her for not being above
that. Well, there's another way to look at it, and that is we know that when she's outspoken, she gets high grades. And this is a political world, and she's doing it because she knows what the first of all, it is an honest appraisal on her part. And second of all, she knows that people are going to like it.
You know, and given that every Republican press release from any House or Senate member of the Trump stripe who puts out a press release and invokes the name of Nancy Pelosi, it's always predicated by five or six right. nasty names. Yeah. So
most of which have been made up by you know who.
Right, exactly. Right. And it's because they work in that environment. So if she wants, I don't know.
Well, no, that's why I say I don't blame her because she's been taking fires constantly.
Exactly.
But
every time we do something like this on the air, somebody will write in and say, don't use the word stupid. It just lowers you.
I don't know.
It just lowers you. And yet, there are those people who listen to public radio who say, let's all play by the Marcus de Queensberry rules. And yet you get a fool like Trump who says, oh, no, that's not what people want. And he does his thing.
You gotta go,
and it works.
Go to the gutter. Terry, you have a different view.
You're a Marcus de Queensberry guy.
While I take great pleasure in having him called what he is, and I can't disagree with that, and I understand where it's coming from, I just do think in the long run, it's just very unbecoming of a leader at her level in our government. And I don't think it's useful or helpful in terms of building a base of support from people that may be on the fence about who they want to support. I just don't think it's ultimately the way a leader should operate, and I don't like it, and I hope that we revert back to a time where we don't do that.
Well, that's stupid.
Well,
no, I'm just kidding.
Maybe so. But, you know, she is in the majority. She has majority control, and the truth of the matter
votes.
Is...
But still,
the truth of the matter is she can more or less do what she wants to do without Kevin McCarthy's approval.
I get it, but also, and I know we're making this an issue instead of talking about what we're set to talk about, but... I mean, doesn't human emotion come into this at some point? You know, I just think of that wonderful Nancy Pelosi moment where at the end of the State of the Union address, she just tears it in half. You know, I mean, that was like I think everyone who disagreed with that president was like just cheering that on. And it seemed like a very real emotion. I don't know. So if you call the guy a moron, after
and he is a moron
and he's been acting like a moron, then I don't know. I mean, I get it, but it seems because it isn't used that often that it does show the level of the degradation of the discourse. I understand your concern that doesn't help matters any. But still.
Well, one is the tearing of the speech is a nonverbal form of communication.
Yeah, but I bet you she regrets that.
But the actual speaking of a name and calling someone a moron is a very different form of communication.
I'll bet she doesn't regret it, Ira.
I'm sure you don't.
Yeah.
I just think that she's, you know, however many years she's got left on this earth, that image is going to follow her. And I just think at some point she's going to say.
But isn't that a great image? I mean, for people who like her,
again,
I think it's a great
speaker
image.
Speaker of the House of the Representatives, you should be above the fray. You can express your dismay with what he said any number of ways. But by doing that, that opens the door for a reply in kind. And where does the cycle of end? Where does
so,
the cycle?
So you and
the cycle ends by a bunch of thugs going to her desk and rooting through her stuff.
Well, that's where I hope that's the end.
Ira Fussfeld on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, July 29th. Full episodes of the Roundtable Panel are available online at WAMC.org. This has been this week's Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.